Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 314. It feels like we've been away forever, but we are back with an amazing new episode for you this week. If you would like to suggest a guest or just get in touch with us, drop us an email, send it on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, strolling over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we at sure as heck like you. An amazing show for you this week. We must get started with our guest. Michael Friedman is an award-winning composer, lyricist, artist, a dramaturg, a professor, and so much more. He has written music and lyrics for the musicals The Fortress of Solitude, Love's Labor's Lost, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, Saved, and The Brand New Kid. For acclaimed theater company The Civilians, he has done The Great Immensity, he's done In the Footprint, and the long-running Gone Missing. He has worked on shows about everything from World War I to the adult film industry to ice hockey. An evening of his songs was featured in Lincoln Center's American Songbook series. He was the dramaturge for the recent Broadway revival of A Raisin in the Sun. He has written for the London Review of Books, the New Yorker, the Paris Review. He's been a McDowell Fellow, a Princeton Hodder Fellow, a Meet the Composer Fellow, a Barron Professor at the Princeton Environmental Institute, and an Artist in Residence at the Spring Workshop Hong Kong. In 2007, Michael Friedman received an Obie Award for sustained achievement. The original cast recording of The Fortress of Solitude was recently released everywhere, including iTunes. It is a must listen. For that work, Michael received two Drama Desk Award nominations, one for music and one for lyrics. But for right this second, he's here with us. Michael Friedman, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you so much.
That's a lot, Michael.
Yeah, that was scary to listen to. I mostly felt old, I guess, listening to that.
Not what we're going for.
That's a long time.
No, we were going for invigorated, not old.
I feel very invigorated.
Nice.
Old and invigorated?
We'll go with it. We'll go with it. Well, let's start with you as we start with all of our, you know, musical and musical adjacent folks. Tell our listening audience, Michael, why the medium of lyrics and music to get your voice out there?
Well, it's funny. I'm a late bloomer on this front. I was a history major in college, history and literature. I was a classical music guy growing up and through school and everything. And so those two things sort of combined. I'd never really written a song before I was about 25.
Wow.
So it's very funny these days. I feel like when I go do stuff at high schools or colleges, you know, you'll meet these like freshmen in college who are like, I've written 17 musicals and three were produced, and you're sort of like, and when I'm trying, people say, you know, what kind of advice could you give me? My path makes no sense when I'm talking to somebody who's like 17 and 76 musicals. So I came to it late sort of through, when I was in college, Elizabeth Suedos, who's a phenomenal composer, lyricist, writer, director, she wrote Runaways and did the musical and a million shows. She came and taught, and actually I got to work with her when I was a senior in college. And then she invited me to, when I moved to New York, I had a job at like a consulting firm doing urban planning.
Of course you did.
She invited me to work. Boy, did I make more money back then. She invited me to work with her on a few shows right when I got to New York.
Okay.
And I was music directing for her. And then it was a sort of magical time in New York City in this odd little period where I kind of was the guy in town who, if a playwright wanted a funny song or a funny, like a little music, a funny little song thing in their show, they asked me to do it because I was like the only game in town who would do it. Maybe it was that I would do it for free.
Okay.
And so I got to know happily, though, like an entire generation of playwrights and directors. And then at some point, I met Steve Cosson, who was about to found the Civilians. And he invited me to be a founding member, and then he asked me to do songs for the first show, which was about, it was a documentary theater piece based on interviews, but really about how maybe Disney had tortured geese on the set of a movie, and then it turned out they hadn't, and we were just foolish and had been misled. But that was the basis of our first show, and that was the first time I really wrote music and lyrics for a show, so it was sort of this funny confluence of things where Steve Costa was like, I bet you could do this thing that I had shown, proved, and there was no proof that I could do it, which I think is one of the great things in theater. And since then, it's kind of been a slow, steady thing, and I've been very lucky. But part of that, I think, is that I've gotten to know so many people in this generation of writers and directors, a lot of really generous and amazing people, and was lucky to kind of be in the right moment at the right place at the right time.
Nice. Now, were you a child of musicals? Was that a part of your upbringing?
I joke that my father passed on to me and my sister football and musical theater, which are, and I guess old movies, but we definitely got football and musicals from him, which is a real combo for this particular show, an unusual combo. I was a child of musical theaters, but not really, more a classical guy, and yeah. So I always liked musicals, but they were a little peripheral to what I was really doing. That said, maybe it's a gay thing, maybe it's a Jewish thing, maybe it's another thing, is, you know, it turns out I know like every verse of every show tune ever written, but I also know like every verse of every Christmas carol ever written. So go figure. I think it's just I pick things up like that.
Yeah.
And one funny thing was that my history background, having done that in school, actually has been, you know, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson came partly because I had in History 1620 in college, taken Jacksonian America and the civilians in a show called Paris Commune. That was I had taken a course in school that studied that. So it's funny how much my background has actually fed writing musicals. You never want to funk it, given my background. But, you know, I'm a classical music history major guy who has ended up writing pop tunes for shows.
So, I love it. I love it.
Life is long and confusing.
Oh, of course it is. It makes for great content. I mean, I will ask, as a fellow gay Jew, was there this point where you had to announce to your family, look, I am going to take this right-hand turn here and move away from history and be in musical theater?
You know, marvelously, or sometimes I worry about it, but I have what I like to call them overly supportive parents.
Nice.
I have parents where sometimes I'm like, maybe you could have warned me that this was, like, maybe you should have, like, laid down the law. You know, now when I'm like, wow, you know, I'm like, maybe I should have gone to law school, or you made me. But I have, they're really marvelous that way, very, very supportive, and also very, very helpful when I've needed advice about things. So in a funny way, that those things like that, both about I would say about career choices and sexuality and a lot of other things that I think, in some ways, I think my big, like, I look at some people, it's just terrible to say this, but I'm like, maybe I've had it on those fronts too easy, so that, you know, it takes away some of the source of material that I think some people get to draw from. I think if you get along with your parents, it can be really hard to, it gets in your way maybe for writing shows.
Yeah. Is law school not still on the table? Because my Jewish mother reminds me all the time that it's still on the table for me.
Oh, I joke with my friend Will that we both keep law school applications in our desk drawer. Just in case. It's like, how did Ben Brantley review the latest show? Okay, now bring out the law school application.
Because it's been a whole 6 hours since my mother reminded me that's still an option for me, you know, so we'll just...
Oh, it's always an option. I like the idea of being a late-blooming law school student.
Oh, I so see you working on Matlock, the musical. That would be wonderful.
We can discuss that, definitely.
That would be wonderful.
Well, really, Murder, She Wrote the Musical is yes. Real dream. I'm just going to announce that.
Well, look, the main accents, it's kind of like a Dolores Claiborne, but with, it could be great.
And you are, and your leading lady is still performing. So
she is.
Still around, so
she
it.
Is. Yeah. Do you see a narrative thread that connects all the different projects that you work on? Is there something that particularly draws you?
I think there's a real, I think that maybe it's my history background and some other things, but a real interest in real stories and real people, which obviously the civilians comes from, because the civilians does work based on interviews or documentary material or investigations into real life. And so we start with meeting, you know, a community or a topic or a historical subject that is based on some kind of research or gathering of evidence, and then we make a show out of it. So Pretty Filthy, we went to the San Fernando Valley and interviewed people in the porn community there.
Yeah.
Mr. Burns and Washburn interviewed the actors involved about about what episode of The Simpsons they remembered the most, and that based her whole play on those interviews, amazingly. This beautiful city, we went to Colorado Springs and hung out in evangelical churches for a year and happened to be there when, like, all kinds of crap hit the fan involving the mega churches there. So, but I think that comes through to other work that I've done, certainly in Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson's, based on historical evidence, and even in the case of Fortress of Solitude, one of the things that really drew me to that book, besides the fact that Jonathan Lethem's novel is astonishing, was how much he kind of had written a history of a time in a way that is almost a history of a time and a place and a cultural world that has kind of been erased.
Yeah.
And even though it's fiction, he really is trying to, it's very autobiographical, and the way he talks about the neighborhood in Gowanus, that is Brooklyn, that he grew up in, the way he talks about his parents, the way he talks about the community he grew up in and how that's changed, and the music he knew as a kid and loved. All of it's fiction, but it also, part of what drew me to it was the truth of that history and what it meant to the real history of America that was going on in that time.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of that is a connection. I'm going to keep talking because I have one other thing to say on that point.
No, do it.
I also think recently I've realized I have a real interest in pop music, or maybe about pop culture and its place in our lives, in our politics, in our world, its meaning beyond being a pleasure, that pop culture also is a major political and ethical force, both negatively and positively.
Yeah.
And so I think that connects a lot. I think part of what was interesting in Bloody Bloody was I was drawing on emo and the question of, like, what does it mean to have a rock star president? I'm working on a show now called American Pop, which is a kind of strange history of pop music before World War I, that I'm trying to figure out sort of all the origin stories and sources of it, and also a little bit of a family history going on there. And then in Fortress of Solitude, it was sort of drawing on all the amazing pop music forms of the end of the 20th century and how they feed into each other, but also how they, in the end of the story of Fortress of Solitude, is very much how pop music can offer solace, and it also can help you paper over the real problems that you're avoiding dealing with.
Right.
So anyway, that was a really long answer to your very good question.
I love it. I love it. Well, before we get, because I want to talk about some of these specific projects in even more detail, let's do a little learning annex with Michael. Do you have a consistent process? Like, if our listeners are thinking, oh gosh, you know, I have these ideas, how do I get them out there? Do you have a specific time of day? Is there that one place that you like to write?
It's funny, I'm a morning guy, which is terrible given my profession and a lot of other things about my life.
But yeah.
I really write in the morning almost always, before 11, which means sometimes I have to wake up at like 4 in the morning to write if I'm on a deadline. And I would say I also, in terms of process, my great hero is this novelist, this 19th century British novelist, Anthony Trollope,
okay,
who was like the postmaster general of England and I think invented the mailbox.
Wow.
But while having this full-time, rather important job, he wrote something like, it was like he wrote maybe 5,000 words a day, which means he wrote these huge novels, but every morning he just got up and wrote and wrote and wrote, and every single morning he wrote a lot, which meant that he got, actually, he always jokes, like, you get really good at doing something if you just do it every day. So it is true that the best thing to do is actually just to keep writing.
Yeah.
And that's what I found is, like, you do get blocked and you do get those things, but actually the hardest part is to just start. And it's very, for me, once I can get over the process of how horrible my first draft will be, the rest of it is actually a lot easier.
Let's turn the page to the other side. Away from the first draft, how do you feel about when you've completed it? Are you one of those, you know, I would have added a half beat there, I would have changed that lyric, or are you able to let it go?
I have famously low standards.
Nice.
I rely on working with really wonderful directors and music directors and collaborators who kind of force my hand to make things better.
Okay.
But I also, I actually, it's weird, I love, My favorite part of a process is the moment when you've started a project. Usually you start a project and you sort of don't know what you're doing.
Okay.
At least a good project, I think you always sort of are trying to figure out how this will work. And then there's this amazing period where you're like, oh, this is how it's going to work.
Yeah.
And then that's the best part for me, is the period where you haven't figured the whole thing out, but you know how it will function, how music will work in this show, what the way you'll structure it and all those things. And then to me, the last part is always, much as that's the amazing part where you're getting produced and the actors are actually doing it, it's always hard because that's the process where you're letting go of the show. There's a great line in Six Degrees of Separation by John Guare where there's sort of a moment where somebody's doing a monologue about seeing their children's paintings in second grade, maybe in school, and says to the teacher, "You've made my child a Matisse. This is amazing. How did you make my child a Matisse?" And the teacher just says, "I just know when to take their paintings away from them." And that, I think, is it's a hard process to let your show go.
Yeah.
But it's less about I'm done, because there's always an extra beat. There's always a revision. You can always start over and find a better way in. But it is that moment where you say, this is the directors now. This is the actors now. We've recorded the cast album. We've let it be licensed around the country. At that moment, you really have to say, like, it's done.
Yeah. Just between you and I and the, tens of thousands of listeners, do you ever have that moment sitting in the audience where an actor says your line and you think, not how I wrote that?
Oh, worse? I have. But even worse, I've had on opening night of more than one show, this is so embarrassing, a moment where an actor is singing something and, the show's done. It's frozen at that point. It's opening. And they're singing and I go, oh, no. I have, in my notebook, I have the rewritten lyric of that.
Oh,
I just forgot
no.
to give it to them. Like, I did that 2 weeks ago. It's just somehow in the, I'm like, that's not the lyric. Oh, no. And I think, and so you'll have, I've talked to other lyricists about that, and I think everyone has one of those, of a thing where this show that's now, it's Oklahoma, and I'm sure there's some line that Oscar Hammerstein was like, oh, I never put in the good new lyric there, So that's, I think, a common truth.
Again, listeners, we are here with composer and lyricist Michael Friedman, whose new memoir, Famously Low Standards, will be coming out very soon. Very
oh, that's
excited.
A good one.
See?
I have a friend who always said my memoir would be entitled a meta narrative predicated entirely on the lack of available men.
There is that.
So maybe Famously Low Standards goes with that.
Oh yeah. Well, that's what takes place after the colon. That's where it's all going down. As a college professor, I know it's all about after the colon. That's where the real drama's going down in those titles.
Okay.
Well, let's talk about some of these specific projects. We have to talk about Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. I don't know if you know this. There's a song that's called Populism. Yeah, yeah.
The origin of that song is one of the saddest origins of any song. I love that song. It was a fun song to write. When I was first working with Alex Timbers, who I've written two shows with, who's a really amazing person to work with, we were joking about what should the opening number be? How would you start a musical that's about Andrew Jackson? We were like, should just be Jackson sing the song? And we kept coming up with, and Alex was like, the show's really going to be about populism, right? Shouldn't it just be like a chorus about populism in America or something? And I just looked at him with great disdain and said, what? You think I'm just going to write some number that's just like populism? Yeah, yeah. And then, walked away witheringly. The next morning I showed up and was like, so I wrote this song called Populism, yeah, yeah. So, never disdain a bad idea because it could turn out to be like a really happy idea. That was what I learned in that moment.
What did you learn about yourself doing that show? Because, that's one of those shows that oft-quoted, critically just celebrated. What'd you learn about yourself during that process?
It was a really, it was actually most of the time, all processes are fraught at some point. That was a happy process almost the whole time. And it took a while. We wrote that show and did a version of it up. I'm at Williamstown Theater Festival right now working on a new musical. And the very first workshop of Bloody Bloody was at Williamstown.
Yeah.
And that was with a non-equity company, a wonderful group of non-equity actors. We were really lucky about that. And it was a lucky process. And I think I learned, it was the first time where I learned to trust Alex, but to trust a collaborator who had a really different voice than I did. And I think both of us on that One Piece, we get along terrifically. But both of us learned, and that was a show where he would sort of go away and write a scene, and I would go away and write a song, and we would show up, and I'd be like, I think we're trying to write a completely different show from each other. And instead of that being true, I think what happened was my songs and his scenes started sort of fighting with each other in a really great way.
Nice.
And the thing I learned about musicals, I don't know what I learned about myself, but what I learned about musicals was sometimes it's really exciting when that happens because there's an energy just in the way that the show is figuring out what it is as it goes.
Yeah.
And that I think was what happened to us. But I definitely learned about myself that I it's important to really work with people you can trust, and to trust that even if you disagree, that if there's a common goal, that disagreement can be really fruitful and exciting. So there was a lot of that. I also learned that was a very lucky show, and then I learned not everything's going to be that lucky. I feel really lucky I got to have a show that was like that.
Yeah.
Kind of just like got, we never expected it to go anywhere. I mean, Alex recently forwarded me an email he'd sent me being like, maybe we could do a 2-week run this summer. Maybe a couple people would come see it before the public agreed to do it. And so it's sort of wonderful when your expectations have been very low. And just in terms of the response you'll get when you get a response totally out of measure of what you were expecting.
Such a great work. Now, Fortress of Solitude, a book that if I read, which I have read Fortress of Solitude and read it with an eye towards turning it into a musical. Now, obviously, music is just all throughout the amazing text. And listeners, if you've never read Fortress of Solitude, it's just an incredible text. I would feel overwhelmed at the prospect of turning that into a score.
It's a funny story. Daniel Auchin, who is an amazing director and colleague, and he used to run Soho Rep, and he's astonishing. He called me and just said, "Have you read this book?" And I'd known Leatham's work before, but I hadn't read Fortress yet. And he said, "Just read it. I think there's something there."
Yeah.
And I read it in about 2 days. I just went really fast. I was in Boston at the time, and I called Daniel back, probably I think weeping because the novel. I grew up in Philadelphia,
yeah.
And a lot of the novel here, it's about Brooklyn, but it really it evokes things from my childhood and adolescence that were really very profound for me. And so I called him, moved profoundly by the book, and I said, "Well, we can't touch this book. It's amazing. No one can turn this into a musical." And then I think like 12 hours later, I called him back and was like, "I reread it. I know how we can do it. We have to get this. Call him. Get it. We have to get this." So that was one where I was overwhelmed. And then, well, like on any musical, I saw the way in, or at least I saw my way in. Which was I sort of saw how the beginning could work, what you could do at the beginning of the novel to put it on stage. And once I saw that, and I also saw how there's a part in the middle of the novel where there's liner notes for an album that never existed. And those were the two things I saw. I was like, that I can do. I know how to do that. And I think we're only, and in a weird way, only I can do that. Which you don't usually feel. So often I feel like weirdly you're like, oh my God, Sondheim would do that so well. Janine Tesori would do a beautiful job with that. I'd love to see Tom Kitt's version of that, but not mine. And in this case, it was one where I was like, I don't want anyone else to get to touch this because I know how to do it. And that's a very, you don't get that experience very often where you know this one's for you. And so that was a happy moment. And the show, I'm really proud of the show, but that was a very exciting moment for me because it felt like I kind of knew how my voice would work with Jonathan's text.
It's so, so great to listen to. You know, I've never had the opportunity to see it. And so to be able to listen to all the music on iTunes, you know, look, there's some shows out there that you can listen to the music and you can get somewhat of a sense of the show. But when you listen to Fortress of Solitude and you go through all those tracks, you really do walk away feeling like, okay, I feel like I know this show now. And that's such a great gift to give everyone, Michael.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. And the horrible, dirty secret of writing musicals is that the most important part of any show is the book. And book writers are the unsung heroes of the theater. There's a few who are vaguely sung, but basically the in the sense that just the structure of how those songs come together and the way that they fit with the book that Edomar wrote, but that Edomar Moses, who collaborated with me on the show, a lot, you know, that he suggested a lot of the ways those songs could work. He threw in ideas for dummy lyrics that really led to how this song would happen. And it's those things, the structuring and the leaving of space for song that is. And at one point, he sort of, a huge, terrifying part of the book in which one of the two lead characters recounts his entire time in prison, the Ballad of Mingus Rood.
Yeah.
Basically, we were like, oh, that's going to be a scene. And at some point, he just wrote in a stage direction in a draft where he just wrote, I think Michael's going to do this, and I think he's going to do a really good job, basically. And I was like, no way. But it was almost like he pushed me into an elevator shaft, but knew I could do it. And I didn't believe I could do it, but I have to say, it's one of the things a book writer does that's amazing, is to say, I know you can write this song. You have to write this song, and I know you can. Uh-huh. And that's some of the things I'm proudest of in the Fortress score, and in a lot of scores, are things where a collaborator said, go do this. I know you're scared of doing this, but go do it.
Yeah. Oh, it's so great. So great to listen to. I've never asked this before. You know, we've talked a lot about musical theater. I'm always curious about how much pressure is on you with the Act One finale. You know, you always hear about, oh gosh, that's the song, Michael. That's the song that you need to carry them through and have them come back after intermission. Is that really a thing, that you feel more pressure for the Act One finale song?
That's so funny. I think, in my experience of both my own musicals, but also other people's, both ones I've liked in the theater, but also talking to people or dealing with younger writers who I'm talking to about their show, it's the beginning, let's be honest.
Yeah.
It's true. You want to send the audience out, and if you can send them out with something that's really exciting, that's a better way of having them come back. But honestly, much more than in a play, where if it takes 20 minutes or 25 minutes for a play to get underway, but then it really slowly but surely hooks people, that's a great play. Like, the greatest plays I know do that, where it starts well, but, like, it might take you a little bit of time to get what's happening, to understand the structure, to get a sense of the world you're in. In a musical, it doesn't mean they have to start dumb. It doesn't mean you have to show everything. But in a weird way, you have about, I think you have about 10 minutes if you're very lucky and you're a genius, but 5 to 10 minutes in which to let them know what world they're in and what they can expect. You can then break those expectations, confound those expectations, change those expectations, but if you don't sort of tell them this is what's going to happen, I think if they don't understand what kind of evening they're in for and the kind of boundaries and rules that you can break later, but again, it's a little bit like a sports game. Like, you have to tell them, here's the playing field, here are the players, here's the world we're in. Then you can be like, actually, haha, there's a whole other playing field under it.
Yeah.
But that said, you do have to, in a different way than a play, lay out your basic things. And it's why, you know, some of the great opening numbers really are like, this is where we are.
Yeah.
These are the people, tradition, or they'll come in and cabaret. You know, being probably the most famous two examples, but the beginning of Into the Woods, where it really is like, these are the stories we're going to tell tonight.
Right.
This is where we are. This is what's going to happen. And those are all really intricately thought through opening numbers. They're not dumb in any way, but they're very, this is a comedy tonight. This is what you're going to deal with. And I think it is very helpful. In Fortress, the opening was the scariest, but it was sort of marvelous and fun to be able to say, this is a block in Brooklyn, and these are all the voices on that block.
Yeah.
And that's what this is about.
Yeah.
And so end of Act One, in a funny way, you could argue, I'm not sure we ever solved the end of Act One in Fortress. If there's any part of it where I still would love another crack at it, I just said that out loud. I think Act One endings, that's more because of a plot issue or an issue of how to get a plot point across. But I think it's the beginning, in the sense that if you get an audience at the beginning, you have them. And if you don't get them at the beginning, it's always a little bit of like, they don't quite trust you, maybe is the best way to put that.
Yeah. Well, let's take that ultimate step back. You're hanging out right now on This Show Is So Gay. Where do you think, you know, being an out gay male plays into your craft?
Well, if you look at my work, I can't believe I just used the term work. If you look at the shows I've done, Pretty Filthy is about porn, and there is one gay for pay sequence. I spent a very dark week in San Diego doing research on gay for pay stuff.
Okay.
Very, very dark week. That we could have a whole other show where I could talk you through that week, but wow, dark. the show really is about the straight porn community. So most of our work was going to straight porn sets and dealing with the men and women in the valley in the straight porn world. And Steve Cosson, who runs the Sillians, and I are both gay, it was kind of funny when all our friends would be like, why are you running a show about straight porn? And then in that said, in this beautiful city, we went to these evangelical churches where also sort of all these New York, many of us homosexuals sort of descended on Colorado Springs. And then in the middle of it, of course, the major huge pastor at the biggest church in America at that moment was outed and had been going through a gay prostitute and had been doing crystal meth and a nightmare. And we sort of were right in the middle of all that. And then actually, in a very weird way, on Bloody Bloody, you know, in Bloody Bloody, there's some pretty out there, on the edge, a couple of the characters in Jackson's cabinet, especially his VP, are pretty out there. And I actually got a lot of flack from a couple of gay magazines about those portrayals, which was so funny because I was like, yeah, I totally contributed to that portrayal. I actually think it's kind of hilarious and interesting. And it was a very interesting question of what are we portraying? Because what we were trying to portray was these sort of foppish aristocrats, which to me, I was like, it's weird that we automatically say that that's a gay thing.
Right.
It got very interesting in what we were portraying on stage and how people responded and how it was a very interesting, and I had a really interesting time trying to kind of parse that. And how can you portray stereotypes on stage in an interesting way? And at what point are those hurtful? At what point aren't they? And if you are from the group, is it different than if you aren't? In that case, it was interesting as a gay man portraying, in a funny way, not homosexuals in that case, but sort of foppish aristocrats who are a little bit flouncy, but are, as far as I know, married, and we give no indication of actual, like, sexual relations.
Yeah.
It was an interesting moment of sort of that question of my identity and what that meant to what was being portrayed on stage. So it's funny how there's been that aspect through shows, and at the same time, I feel like I've written these sort of, sometimes I look back and I'm like, I need to write a show that's just like a gay show, like,
yeah,
with like gay people being gay. I have an idea right now for a, you know, did that come out weird? I have an idea for a dance musical that sadly all my ideas are for like really depressing ideas. But
great.
This one is something that I've kind of been running away from for a while, and it's an idea that I really am into. It's hard, and it will be hard to do, but it would be a very, very gay show.
All right.
In a lot of ways.
Well, hey, so, if it's a so gay show, you get to come back on here and talk about it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I will look forward to, if this show happens, to coming back. So that's, I guess, my response to me. I don't know. In terms of trying to identify that, I love to look for threads of things, and I sort of just gave you that. But I think it's a tricky business figuring it out. I think we all look at, you know, we all live in the shadow of Sondheim, and I think that's for good and for problematic in different ways. But I think trying to find that in his work is really tricky, because you can find it, the sexual identity, and at the same time, it sort of comes and goes, and when you try to find it too hard, I think you get confused,
right?
If that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah.
And if, anyway, when it shows up most is when it's least interesting. And then there's, you know, the very, very famous problem child, which is Company, which no one knows how to deal with.
Right. Well, for, you know, look, to close this out, I will ask you the question we've talked about so many times over the years. I am so fortunate, and I acknowledge my privilege left, right, up and down, that I grew up in the New York City area, and my folks took us to musicals nonstop. But at a time when you didn't have to leverage your mortgage to go see a ton of musicals in a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so one topic that comes up all the time, would love to get the definitive Michael Friedman take on the state of musical theater as an art form, specifically around accessibility. You know, that's what we always worry about.
Well, can I flip that on its head and say a really interesting thing?
Yes.
I have two thoughts about that.
Yeah.
One is, I think that the flip of that is, at least when I was young, like, musicals were kind of the bastard, you know, the bastard purple-haired stepchild of culture. Like,
yeah.
They weren't just gay. They were, I mean, in the sense of, like, in a negative, it's horrible that I just said gay in the negative sense. But they weren't just, like, something that,
sure,
like, weird gay people in New York like and, like, show tune loving. They were, like, really, like, a sad little subculture. And I mean that with a love for musicals that I've always had.
Absolutely.
And I actually think there's an argument that that's what's good for musicals, that they should be transgressive, they should be problematic, they should be sort of fighting for their lives. And now we live in a very interesting time when college students are writing musicals, and everyone likes musicals, and on television people do musicals. And in a funny way, like, suddenly musicals are right at the center of the culture. I think there's some aspect for what we lose with that is the transgressive nature of the beast. So that was one. So in a funny way, while Broadway is more expensive than ever, yes, I think at the same time, people in colleges and high schools and community theaters and just anywhere you go are doing musicals constantly and doing actually new musicals constantly and sort of interested. The idea of, quote, Broadway, the idea of these shows is much more alive than when I was. We didn't know. We knew of shows that were on Broadway, but we didn't think of them as kind of part of our culture necessarily. So that's I think, a real change. And as I said, for the good and for the bad in different ways. I also would say that I take a really, really long view about musical theater, which is, you know, music theater is older than spoken theater. It goes back to the Greeks, and that was music theater before there was just a spoken theater. And it goes back to the Greeks, and it involves the Greeks, and it involves opera, and it involves Shakespeare. I just did The Tempest for Shakespeare in the Park, and that's full of tunes and full of dances and full of music. And it goes through opera and grand opera and operetta and early musicals and recent musicals and rock musicals and concept albums. And it's a very long history. That's not going away. There will always be a need to express. Theater will always exist. People always have a need to go to a room and see people reflect something back at them. And musical theater will always exist. It's going to be fine. Whether the musical as the American idea of a canon will go the way of, like, grand opera, which only lasted for about 100 years.
Right.
We now still have opera, but it's a different thing. That might be true, but I also look forward. I actually feel like we're ripe for, you know, the most hardening moment in the history of musical theater for me is this weird moment when someone named Mozart showed up and transformed the Singspiel in German and transformed the opera buffa in Italian into arguably the greatest works of music of all time. And I think that's what's exciting, is that the musical is always, the door is always open. There is always a chance of something new being invented. And I think the danger is of saying that it's this one, it's of lamenting a form. Music theater is going to be fine.
Yeah.
And I think it's true, and accessibility is important. But in that sense, the accessibility is less important than, you know, we need to deal with the fact that this country is completely screwed up in its economics and financial issues and the disparity of wage earning and blah, 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 all these things that we know about. And if that was, you know, if we could fix that, then the problem of Broadway tickets would go away.
I love it.
So that's my argument.
I
have a very positive view if you take a really long.
I am fine with all that. Well, listeners, three things that I must review for you. First of all, everybody needs to go over to YouTube and type in "The Song Makes a Space," because that is Michael doing a TED Talk that I freaking adored, Michael.
Oh,
I
thanks.
Loved
I was really
it.
Proud of that talk. Thank you so much.
So do that. Number two, I'm going to correct you because you paused when you described your work and using the word work. Michael, when you win an Obie Award for sustained achievement, it means you have a body of work. It's a great thing.
Thank you.
Okay. Number three, listeners, please, please, stroll on over to iTunes, download Fortress of Solitude. Newsday called it original and authentic, and I have to say that not only describes Fortress of Solitude, that whole soundtrack, but certainly the composer and lyricist. You're putting great stuff out there, Michael. It is such a treat to have you on the show.
Oh, my gosh. It's been a real treat talking to you. Thank you so much.
Keep doing what you're doing, my friend.
You too.
Why wouldn't you ever go out with me in school? You always went out with those guys who thought they were so cool. And I was just nobody to you, nobody to you, nobody to you. But it's the early 19th century, and we're gonna take this country back. For people like us who don't just
sometimes with speeches too, and also other things.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Populism, yeah, yeah. Populism, yeah, yeah. Populism, yeah, yeah. Populism, yeah, yeah.
This is the age of, this is the age of, this is the age of Jackson.
All right, folks, and we are back. I feel like it's been forever since we've had a new episode. I missed you guys. People have been writing in saying you haven't done new episodes in a couple weeks, and indeed, I needed a couple weeks off. I had such an adventure in Colorado. Unfortunately, I came back a little bit injured, so I've been tending to myself and getting new guests together, and we have all of these great episodes coming up. But first, we have time on this week's episode to talk about all the latest LGBT news out there, and there is quite a bit going on. Really exciting news out of Washington, D.C. Senator Michael Bennet of Colorado has introduced a bill that would assist the ever-growing ranks of LGBT elders. LGBT elders. That's one of those populations that we just don't talk about enough. And as people are coming out earlier and earlier, we're also getting more and more LGBT elders. The LGBT Elder Americans Act was filed this week. It was first introduced in 2012, but there seems to be action now. The bill follows this week's White House Conference on Aging and announcement by Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Julian Castro that LGBT seniors will be protected from discrimination in public housing, which is very exciting. The guidance issued by HUD states that administrators of all HUD-assisted housing cannot base decisions on actual or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity. And Senator Bennet said this in a statement, "As baby boomers continue to age, it's important that we understand the unique needs of this diverse generation. For LGBT seniors, questions about healthcare and financial issues can be particularly difficult without a trustworthy advocate to help guide them through these challenging decisions." The statement goes on to say, "And now, with full marriage equality, thankfully the law of the land, many older LGBT couples have additional planning decisions to make. This bill will help aging service organizations assist older LGBT adults and their caregivers. Above all, it will provide LGBT seniors and their families the peace of mind that their best interests are being considered." That is Senator Michael Bennet of Colorado, a bill that will assist LGBT elders. And the bill has a number of different provisions, and I encourage you to go read about them. I'm looking at 7 right here that are just all such good things. One of them, this bill would include LGBT older adults as a population with greatest social need, and that characterization targets services and programs to those facing barriers caused by non-economic factors, including cultural, social, geographical isolation, all those different things. And so it actually will funnel programming money towards LGBT seniors. It's really, really exciting. It is one of those populations that we don't talk about nearly enough. So LGBT seniors getting some assistance there in Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, on the other side of the spectrum, we have LGBT youth. And LGBT youth were not helped this week by our senators, by our Congress folks in Washington, D.C. The U.S. Senate voted this week on a measure protecting LGBT students from harassment. Unfortunately, it failed. That bill failed. Colorado Congressman Jared Polis, he's one of our out gay Congress folks out there, he said it was, quote, historic that the U.S. Senate even voted on it, but so unbelievably disappointing that it failed. You just can't imagine why bills like this fail. But though an LGBT-specific amendment to the proposed Every Child Achieves Act only received 52 of the 60 votes it needs to overcome the typical Senate gridlock, Congressman Jared Polis, said it's evidence Congress realizes it must do something about the country's beleaguered LGBT youth. All of the Democrats voted for it. Not all the Republicans voted for it. It was blocked by Republicans. It failed on a 52-45 vote this week. Jared Polis, he remains hopeful. He said this, quote, "Today, a majority of U.S. senators recognized this truth by voting to end bullying against LGBT students. While it didn't receive the 60 votes necessary for passage, this represents a giant step forward in our effort to make sure LGBT students have a safe and welcoming place place to learn. Just such a bummer, such a bummer that this was, I mean, bummer, what a horrible way to dial this down and characterize this. But yeah, it was blocked by Republicans. All of the Democrats in our U.S. Senate voted for it, a couple Republicans, but most of the Republicans voted against it, so it does not pass. The Human Rights Campaign, who, gosh, are they under fire all over the place, but they did issue what is being called a defiant note. They said, quote, "Although a solid majority of senators voted for this vital legislation, we are deeply disappointed that Republican leaders insisted on a supermajority 60-vote threshold for passage." And that was from the Human Rights Campaign's Government Affairs Director, David Stacey. Three-quarters of LGBT students, just to remind you all, three-quarters of LGBT students report verbal harassment at school. That's according to GLSEN, the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network. They also report that half of those students are being bullied online, and more than a third face physical attacks or harassment. So we're in this place where we need something like this. We need a bill to pass that protects our LGBT youth, and unfortunately, very much did not pass the U.S. Senate this week. So yay for LGBT elders, and boo on the Republicans in Senate. And, you know, it's, how can you sit there and argue that these things don't happen along party lines? Because they do. They absolutely do. I've seen some great articles out there in the past couple of weeks saying, can we not forget that all of these things that are happening under President Obama? Marriage equality, it happened under President Obama. Getting rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that happened under President Obama. It really does make a difference who you vote for. All of these other advances happened under President Obama. So very, very exciting advances, but then you also are reminded that there are other folks in Washington who just don't have the same agenda. So it's a bummer. It's a bummer. There are folks that are speaking out against discrimination where and when it happens. Jim Kenney is the Democratic mayoral candidate in Philadelphia. He called this week for Waldron Mercy Academy in Marion to reinstate Margie Winters. Margie Winters is the lesbian teacher who recently lost her job at a Philadelphia area Catholic school. She's getting support not only from the parents of her students, but also from Jim Kenney, who is likely to be the next mayor of Philadelphia. Jim Kenney also contended that her firing was the work of cowardly men, quote, cowardly men in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, although archdiocesan officials have denied any involvement. Jim Kenney said this, quote, "If you're a church official and you feel that strongly, that this woman and her partner are such a threat to society, stand up and say so." Jim Kenney considers himself a Catholic, quote, "who has clashed with the church on LGBT rights issues." In heavily Democratic Philadelphia, Jim Kenney is likely to beat Republican candidate Melissa Murray Bailey in this year's election to succeed term-limited Mayor Michael Nutter. Margie Winters has been married to Andrea Vittori for her entire 8-year tenure at the elementary school, and the teacher has said school officials knew of the marriage when hiring her. They advised Winters that she could be open about her personal life with fellow faculty members, but to avoid discussing it with students or parents. She said she followed those instructions, but recently some parents became aware of her relationship. One complained to Walden Mercy administrators, another to the Archdiocese. Winters was fired in June. It's crazy. She was an amazing teacher by all accounts, and she was fired. Principal Nell Stetzer has declined to discuss the reasons for the dismissal, citing confidentiality of personnel matters, but her communications on the matter have referred to the necessity to adhere to Catholic doctrine, which, of course, opposes same-sex marriage. So kudos to Jim Kenney, the Democratic mayoral candidate there in Philadelphia. Sounds like he is soon to be the mayor of Philadelphia, for speaking out. And, you know, our thoughts are with Margie Winters and her partner, Andrea Vittori. You're just doing your job. They're just doing her job, living her life, being an amazing teacher, you know, in a country that desperately needs amazing teachers. And she gets fired because of her personal life. It's just crazy. She gets fired for being in an amazing relationship. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Turning our attention to some more firings or denial of benefits, certainly. A Walmart Stores Inc. employee is now suing the retailer of Walmart, saying its prior policy of denying health insurance to the spouses of gay employees violated gender discrimination laws. The lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court in Boston. It seeks nationwide class action status. Walmart is the largest private U.S. employer out there. They began offering health insurance benefits to same-sex spouses last year after the U.S. Supreme Court in 2013 struck down the part of the Defense of Marriage Act that denied federal benefits to married gay couples. Even after that change, the lawsuit says Walmart workers still live with the uncertainty of losing spousal coverage. The lawsuit says this, quote, benefits provided by Walmart as a matter of grace are not secure and could potentially be withdrawn just when large healthcare costs are incurred. Jackie Coate, who has worked at Walmart stores in Maine and Massachusetts since 1999, said in the lawsuit that her wife, Diana Smithson, developed cancer in 2012, and the denial of insurance led to more than $150,000 in medical debt. Coate and Smithson were married in Massachusetts in 2004, days after the court ruling then in 2004 in Massachusetts made the state the first to allow gay nuptials. So now suing Walmart. Hopefully this becomes just part of the way that Walmart does business. They code it right there into their policies, and it doesn't feel like employees, and this is what the lawsuit is looking to change. It doesn't feel to employees as if it can be withdrawn at any minute. So definitely keeping our eyes on Walmart and the Boy Scouts. So there's this great piece over on CNN.com about the ban on gays serving openly in leadership positions in the Boy Scouts, and it looks like the tide is turning. The Boy Scouts of America has moved one step closer to ending its ban on gay adults as leaders. The organization's executive committee adopted a resolution just last week that would change the policy. The Boy Scouts said this in a statement this week, quote, this resolution will allow chartered organizations to select adult leaders without regard to sexual orientation, continuing Scouting's long-standing policy of chartered organizations selecting their leaders. This change allows Scouting members and parents to select local units chartered to organizations with similar beliefs that best meet the needs of their families. This change would also respect the right of religious chartered organizations to continue to choose adult leaders whose beliefs are consistent with their own. So it's a bit of a change. It's certainly not everything that everybody wants to see. Zach Walls, who's the executive director for Scouts for Equality, we actually talked about them a few weeks ago, he said this, quote, for decades, the Boy Scouts of America's ban on gay adults has stood as a towering example of explicit institutional homophobia in one of America's most important and recognizable civic organizations. While this policy change is not perfect, and just this is Ken Schneck saying it really is not perfect, Boy Scouts of America's religious chartering partners will be allowed to continue to discriminate against gay adults. It is difficult to overstate the importance of today's announcement. So, one step closer. It's definitely a good thing. One person who had something to say about this was Scott Walker. Scott Walker, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who he's only a few days into his formal campaign for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination, he said he's already taking heat for a comment that appears to imply that gay Boy Scouts and leaders are predators. Jeez. Speaking to the conservative Independent Journal Review, the governor weighed in on this news that the Boy Scouts will allow chartered organizations to select their leaders, and he said this, quote, I was an Eagle Scout. My kids have been involved. My wife, Tanette, was a den mother. I have had a lifelong commitment to the Scouts and support the previous membership policy because, and here it is, folks, this is from presidential candidate Scott Walker. He said that he supports the previous membership policy because it protected children and advanced Scout values. So he is essentially saying that the Boy Scouts need protection from other gay Scouts and from gay leaders. So depressing that a presidential candidate would put this out there. This week, after he said that, he was at a campaign stop in Las Vegas. He was asked to clarify his comments, but he basically repeated his earlier remarks, noting that he was an Eagle Scout, his sons were Boy Scouts, and his mother, in addition to his wife, was a den mother. He said, quote, I think their previous policy was personally fine. So yeah, basically, this is a presidential candidate just saying, gays are predators. They're predators. Human Rights Campaign President Chad Griffin blasted Walker in a statement this week. He said, quote, Scott Walker's suggestion that the Boy Scouts of America's current discriminatory policy somehow protects children from gay adults is offensive, outrageous, and absolutely unacceptable. His comments imply that we represent a threat to the safety and well-being of young people, end quote. I will just say that it seems like the Human Rights Campaign is coming out with stronger and stronger statements, which is great. I hope it's for all of the great reasons and not because they've been under so much fire lately, but I don't really care why. It's a great thing. It's a great thing. So that, my friends, that's the news for this week. Again, it feels like it's been so long. Our huge, huge thanks to composer, lyricist, dramaturge, professor, all of those, Michael Friedman, just such an amazing presence in the musical theater scene. If you have not listened to Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, if you have not listened to Fortress of Solitude first, I urge you to go read the book. The book Fortress of Solitude is amazing. And then go listen to the musical, because what Michael Friedman and all the other folks who worked on that were able to do with that book, it's just, it's incredible. It's incredible. So our thanks to him, our thanks to you all. It's great to be back. Get out there. Go do whatever it is that you do to use your voice to make a difference with your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. Raise up underrepresented voices, be they LGBT youth, LGBT seniors, or anybody in between. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
This little world can seem so big without anyone to love.
My mother always says
to love
that a Brooklyn kid won't grow up with the hang-ups that she did.
Oh, this little world,
my mother always says,
can make you feel trapped
if we learn
inside
from the street.
A ball of glass.
I can learn from the kids
with
I meet
above,
and not believe.
And there's no escape.
Here in Brooklyn, people aren't uptight, and I won't grow up only having friends who are white. She says, that's how I see it, that's how it is. She says, that's how I see it, that's how it is. Oh, I don't know what that means, but she said she'd rather die than have me grow up in Queens. Now I'm trying to find the beat, I'm trying to find the beat, I'm trying to find the beat, but the time keeps changing, the time keeps changing on me. My mother always says, knock on every door, and if it's hard at first, just go and knock some more. 'Cause all the changes that the world has known never happen if you act alone, singing on your own. Then she lets me put on a song, and sometimes we just sit there and sing along. California dreaming, California. My mother always says that the block will be the beginning of a new society. She says that I'm gonna go to public school so I don't become a privileged fool. She says that's a rule. At first it will be hard, but soon it'll be fulfilling. The times they are a-changing, that's why she named me Dylan. I know there's an answer. You can make it if you try. She says if I listen, I can learn to. So I'm trying to find the beat, I'm trying to find the beat, I'm trying to find the beat, but the time keeps changing, the time keeps changing.
That's how I see it, that's what I know. Sometimes you get the urge for going, oh babe, I hate to go. And if the dreams that we share don't go as planned,
says that a Brooklyn kid won't grow up with the hang-ups that she did. And Dad paints upstairs. I eat breakfast alone.